The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I'm talking with Anna Brockway, the co-founder and chief marketing officer of one of my favorite sites to shop, Chairish. For those of you who don't know it, and trust me, you will fall in love immediately, Chairish is an incredible resource for buying the best decor, art, furniture. Really, it's like all amazing things for the home. The company lists over 1,000 new arrivals every single day and has over 1 million monthly shoppers. But Anna wasn't always in the world of interiors and e-com, oh no. In her first career, she worked in the fashion space as the vice president of worldwide marketing for Levi's. Yep, as in denim, not decor. We sat down to talk about why she'd moved from her mega career in marketing at one of the most respected American brands ever to starting her own thing, and I'm so glad that we did. This is Anna Brockway on Second Life. So, Anna, with this podcast, we always like to start at the beginning. So tell me, what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
In school, I studied art history really with a focus on architecture. I grew up in a small town in Northern California called Arvinda. And it was a really great place to grow up, but it was sort of like a great town if you wanted to be on the swim team, but not so much, you know, if you wanted to move to New York and, you know, hang out in art galleries. So I sort of bolted out of there as soon as I could and went to Columbia and studied there. And it was a really amazing experience. And I think I always thought I would be somehow involved in the fashion or entertainment industry simply because that's what I cared about and what I spent a lot of time kind of in my head on when I was growing up. That was where my fantasy life was.
And it's interesting because I do think that you can trace back everyone's career to some of those early seeds. Uh-huh. Like, for example, when I was in junior high and high school, when I would get in trouble and my mother would ground me, she would take away or throw away my magazine collection because that was the worst possible punishment. There's always some of those early seeds there.
Yes,
so
for sure.
What was your first job after graduation?
It's funny. It actually ended up kind of being my job for almost 15 years. So I'm sort of one of those weird people who kind of found something and stuck with it. So my first job out of college, I moved back from New York to San Francisco, and I went to work at an ad agency called Footcone & Belding.
So that's not art history.
Not art history. Not at all art history.
What made you decide to do that?
Well, I had interned over the summer at Chiat Day, which is, you know, this big ad agency, and I loved being around all the creative people and working on accounts, and I liked the selling part of it, oddly. I thought it was really fun. And to me, it was sort of the perfect kind of coming together of creativity and also a business sensibility. So for me, that was oddly really fascinating. And advertising especially, I mean, I'm 47 now, so we're talking about late 80s, early 90s. Advertising was insane.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was the days where people routinely spent, you know, a couple $1 million on commercial production. And we worked with Herb Ritts and Albert Watson and all the big photographers. I worked on the Levi's account. So it was a really, really fun time in my life. And I started off there because, like, junior account executive in charge of envelope stuffing and stapling. And then after about 4 or 5 years there working on the Levi's business, I actually got moved over. I was hired away by Levi Strauss and went to work for them. And I worked there for a really long time. And when I left, I was the head of their worldwide marketing division, which really was overseeing marketing for the entire Levi's brand, which is huge and really fun.
So what was your day-to-day like? And how did you how did you make that climb? How did you know Levi's was the right place for you? Like,
explain some of that to me.
Well, the thing I always loved about working for Levi's is two things. I mean, one, as a brand, it's a super democratic brand. It's obviously an American icon, but also is a brand that is sort of anti-fashion fashion. And as somebody who grew up in California, and Levi's are from San Francisco, and I grew up in the Bay Area, it was just a really big part of my childhood and kind of almost had mythic status. So for me, it was such an honor to be able to work on that brand. Secondly, it was a brand that had, you know, this is back in the days of, you know, Sagan and hip hop, and like there was so much going on in denim that it was a really exciting time to be in that portion of the market. And it was when, if you can believe it, Levi started for the first time getting serious about making jeans for women, because before women were just expected to wear guys' jeans or the kind of like mom jeans. Yeah, so that was really fun, was to be able to work on bringing femininity to a product that had always been very masculine. And so that was super fun. And then lastly, you know, Levi's is owned by a family, and they were really interesting, nice people. They put together an amazing team. And they kind of let me do a lot of different things. So I was never bored there, because I stayed there during the whole entire, like, dot-com 1.0 and even dot-com 2.0, like, still there. And I was always working on something new. I was always working with people I thought were fantastic. I had great creative inspiration all around me. And so it was like, not broken, don't fix it. So right. I stayed there for a really long time, and I loved it.
Well, I always love the idea of, like, when there is room for personal growth and professional growth at a company, staying and continuing to rise. I mean, it's something we try to do at Click Brands is, you know, set people up for success and to promote from within. Sometimes it doesn't always work timing-wise, but that's sort of the goal always, because I think there's something so valuable, even in this day and age when people bop from job to job to job, and I get that, there is also something that's really unique and interesting about growing inside a company and being able to understand it in a different way from just the, you know, institutional knowledge of being there for 5 years or 8 years or however long.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I think I was good at doing, if I can say that, was saying what I wanted to work on that I hadn't done yet. So, you know, Levi's was launching Levi.com, and it was so funny. No one's going to buy jeans on the internet. That's what everybody said, and we were like, let's try it. So, you know, we got to work on new stuff, and, you know, for whatever reason, they just felt comfortable saying, okay, like, go ahead, let's see what can happen, and getting product placement started. I mean, so many fun new initiatives that I was allowed to partner with teams and work on that were just, it kept me from getting bored.
So speaking of that, let's talk about marketing for a minute. What are, for people who are interested in the idea of marketing but don't necessarily know what that actually, like, nuts and bolts down to on a day-to-day basis, can you talk about a little bit, like, sort of your trajectory and the scope of the things that fell under your responsibility?
Yeah, so it's a great question, because it's a big word and lots of different,
and it's different
things.
Different
and,
places.
And it's different places, and there's lots of specialties within it. So when I started off, I was working on, which does sort of relate back to studying, you know, architectural portion of art history, although in a very commercial way, was I started working on building out stores. So Levi's was pioneering at the time the idea of building stores within stores. Now we're very used to them. But at the time, it was a new idea. So I worked on that. So that's called retail marketing, which is, you know, how does your brand present physically? And then I started working on traditional advertising, so big budget ad campaigns, television, print,
the internet. And that means casting, conceiving,
working with ad agencies, briefing them in on what you want done, briefing in a media plan, figuring out what's the right reach, frequency, channels that you should be on. So media in itself has blown up to be its own entire discipline and specialty on a level beyond, I think, where it's ever been before, and super interesting, and where so much innovation is now. But and then there was the creative side of working with the agency. Then there's the publicity portion, which is getting your product, in our case for jeans, getting worn by the right people, photographed at the right events. We set up some of the first product suites at Sundance and Video Music Awards and all these things to get, you know, young, cool people wearing our product. And then, you know, beyond that, when I started working on the international component, was really like, how does this brand present on a worldwide basis, and how can we learn from each other on a worldwide basis? So what are we learning in Europe that can inform what we're doing in the States, and vice versa?
Did you ever have any like crazy insights about like, wow, like the way that the denim, the way that Levi's presents in Japan has, you know, great learnings for the U.S. or?
Yeah, I think for me, for Levi's was always so inspiring to see how Levi's was considered, was sort of taken for granted in America as kind of like the, you know, kind of like the milk in the back of the grocery store when it came to clothes. And that changed when it launched and really got important, I think, in women's fashion in particular. And then we started to see more parity where it was considered, it was valued as a fashion statement the way it always had been in Europe and certainly in Eastern Europe where it was really considered, you know, currency for a long time. People would trade Levi's for cars and things like that.
No.
Because you weren't allowed to have American product. So it was really fascinating to see that differentiation in value by country.
That's so cool.
And inspiring and kind of reminding me of, you know, why is this brand important? Is because it was and is a symbol of, like, American values fundamentally.
Interesting.
And and openness.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So what were some of the biggest career lessons that you learned in your time at Levi's?
Well, I think firstly to say what you want and be willing to try things. I feel really lucky that I worked in a place where it was okay to fail. Maybe it was too okay to fail. When I look back on some of the things they kind of had me working on, I'm like, I don't know if I was really qualified to be doing that, but I learned a lot doing it. So that was the first thing. And I think also for me, it became a lot about working on something where I felt very aligned with the values of the brand that I was essentially selling and marketing. I mean, I believe in the openness and the democratic nature fundamentally that is the DNA of the Levi's brand. For me, that was really inspiring to be part of that. And I loved the anti-fashion fashion kind of juxtaposition. That was really fun. So I think if you don't have that kind of interest, engagement, and passion for what you're working on, it makes it a lot harder and less fun.
One of the things that when people have asked for career advice over the last, you know, decade plus, one of the things that I always tell them is that think about what brands really resonate with you just as a civilian in your day-to-day and then start looking at those companies first, because I think that the best people from – I think the happiest employees are people who work for brands that they really connect with.
Right.
That they really believe in, where it's not just a job but where they believe in the mission. And it sounds like that's –
yeah.
What you had.
We used to say it's not a job, it's a calling. And I think if you're working on something you really love, it shows. And certainly when we're hiring at Cherish now, I look for people who, you know, in their spare time are redesigning their best friend's apartments and imagining what a house that they went to on an open house might look like when they loaded their furniture. I mean, people who fantasize about this stuff, that's to me the sign of true passion. And that's how I know that, like, okay, you're crazy enough to work here.
That's one time I remember I hired an assistant at one point in time and she had a full-time day job. But then she had a blog at night that she would work on that she was putting hours and hours and hours into. And it was just for her. And that's when it made me realize, like, okay, maybe the skill set isn't there on paper necessarily, but clearly the passion is
right
there. And I can teach a CMS, but you can't teach
right
passion in
yeah
the same way.
No, I look for the people who open up their handbag and they have crumpled tear sheets from magazines and sketchbooks with stuff falling out of them and, you know, 8,000 Pinterest boards. I'm like, oh yeah, we're the same. We're equally nuts. Welcome to the insane asylum.
So you were at Levi's for a while.
A long time.
And then,
I think almost 15 years. Yeah.
What made you decide to leave?
So I had a baby. And my husband has a long career in startups. And he was working like a madman. And I was working like a madwoman and traveling a lot. And we became pregnant with our first baby. And I actually missed my 6th month checkup appointment at my doctor because I just couldn't figure out how to get in between the flights and the meeting and the board thing and, you know, all the stuff. And I thought to myself, like, that's not an appointment I want to miss. And we both sort of looked at each other and his business was going well enough that we felt confident that we could make that choice. And so I left. And
were you freaked out about leaving?
Totally freaked out. It was so weird. I mean,
because this has been your identity.
Totally.
For your entire adult life. 100%.
And all of a sudden, I was like out at 10 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, at a Starbucks, like, oh my God, all these people aren't at where? This is where everyone's been. like, oh, now I get it. Not everyone's, you know, doing what I used to do. This is like this whole other opportunity. But yeah, it was. It was a really humbling experience. It was great in a way. I felt a lot. I mean, obviously, you feel a lot of release from the stress and the worry and all the anxiety that comes with
a big career.
But it's also like, it's a little bit like you kind of are addicted to the adrenaline. And so you have to kind of find other things. So it was interesting. So Oliver, my oldest son, was born. And then about a year later, my half-sister, who was 13, came to live with us full-time. And then 6 months after, I think it was about 6 months after she moved in, we found out we were pregnant with twins. So I went from no kids to four kids with a teenager in 24 months. So that kind of got me over the adrenaline trough because it cranked right back up again. And so I spent 10 years at home raising those four kids and kind of getting everybody started. So it was wild.
Yeah. On a side note, I have to say that if anyone could handle like that level of wrangling and details and all of that, I mean, like, you obviously were an amazing person to handle all of that. But what was your day-to-day like then? It was just all kids all the time? Or were you thinking about your next step? Did you think you would be a stay-at-home mom indefinitely? What was your plan?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So my mom actually was a stay-at-home mom up until I was about 14. And when my parents divorced, my mom, instead of getting an alimony payment or whatever they call that, she instead said to my dad, "I just want you to pay my way through law school." And so here's my mom, who hasn't worked for almost 20 years, and before that had been a school teacher, saying, I've always wanted to be a lawyer, and this is my chance. And so she went to law school. She went to USF. This one, I was living in Orinda. I was in high school. And when I was a freshman in college, my mom passed the bar, and she went to work in the district attorney's office in Oakland and had this whole other career as a—
Get her on the show.
Talk about Second Life. Yeah, she should be on the show. She's really the baller. But yeah, so I guess for me, it always felt like being a stay-at-home mom for me was just kind of a phase. And I always thought I would do something. It was just a matter of figuring out what. And actually, staying at home with four kids, and we had to move a lot because we think, oh, this house is big enough. And then it was like, oh, wait, there's twins. Oh, wait, there's a teenager. Someone's falling out the window. Like, we have to go buy another. You know? So we, like, kept moving. So we moved a lot in that time period. And it, you know, as a creative person, home a lot, it made me even more obsessed with home design than I probably was before. And that's really what gave me the idea to start Cherish. So it came directly from that experience.
Tell me about Cherish's origin story.
So I'm a vintage fanatic, and I think part of it comes from my days working for Levi's, and I spent a lot of time in the vintage portion of the fashion business because that's, I think, where trend starts. And for me, it's the most interesting thing. And then also—
Well, that's your art history.
That's my art history. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, thanks. You're connecting the dots for me here. So when I started it, I really had just gone through this, as I was saying, this experience of moving and as a creative person, like, and I was going to be in this space all day, like what it looked and felt like was really important to me. And so I spent a lot of time going to vintage shops and flea markets and sample sale. I mean, you name it. I went there and shopping online because that was just starting at the time. And we would get something all ready, and I think the house looked great. And then it was like, oh, wait, now we have to move. And so we were constantly in this process, and I realized how hard it was to and how complicated it was to decorate your own home. And especially when you had things to sell and you liked vintage and you wanted to buy it, it's like really the only option was like eBay, which was really hard and kind of scary. Yeah. Or Craigslist, which was gross. We had moved it again, and we were having this conversation. I was like, what are we going to do with all this stuff? And I said, I just wish there was a place where we could easily sell our things to people who get it. Like, these are nice things. They're not junky junk. And he said, you should start a website. And I was like, no. I'm not the one who starts websites. You're the one who starts websites, because that's what he'd done. And we sort of looked at each other and said, well, maybe we should try it. And so right then and there, I poured myself a big glass of Chardonnay, put on my bathrobe, which is when all good things start to happen. And I was like, what should we call it? And so, you know, I say that from actually having that conversation with Greg to launching it was about 3 months. So it was pretty fast.
That's the same thing with me and Catherine.
Yeah.
We talked about it. She came to me and said, I'm thinking about starting a website. I said, cool. She's like, I want you to do all of the writing for it. I said, yes. And she's like, and I'll do the art, and let's just do it. I said, yeah. And she said, maybe you should think about it. I was like, no, I did. Let's do this. It just sounded like, cool. Yeah, of course. Let's do it. And from that day until our first story, I think was like 2 months.
Yeah. I actually really believe that's important. One of the things I've observed with, like, you, I get asked a lot, you know, how did you get it started? Why did you get it started? How can I get my idea started? Is the more you think about it, the more reasons there are not to do it.
And you can overthink things.
And you talk yourself out of it, or you spend a lot of time working on an idea and perfecting it in your brain or on a piece of paper or in a quote-unquote deck. And as soon as you put it out there and it becomes real in the universe, you get feedback that makes you totally ball up that paper, throw it in the trash, and start again. So the sooner you can kind of manifest something and get a reaction to it, the faster you'll get to the answer. And that's totally what happened to us, because the company is very different today than what I just described.
So tell me about what were those early days like?
Yeah. So
Also, what year is this?
This is 5 years ago. So like end of 2012, beginning of 2013. So we're in the dining room. I kind of by accident ended up buying the name Cherish. Greg was not working at the time. He had just sold a business. And so we kind of brought in his engineering partner, who he'd worked with on a couple of other businesses, and we started talking about it. And we kind of set up this really, honestly, quite ugly Shopify site, and we listed all of our own furniture on it, because God knows, as
did
a compulsive shopper.
Pictures of it
yourself?
I took
pictures of them and uploaded it.
Like, did you merch it, or was
no,
it was just point and shoots?
It was point and shoots, and it was a guess for what stuff should cost, because there really wasn't any way of knowing. And Greg was like, wait, I don't necessarily want to sell that. I'm like, well, we only have 20 things on the site, so we have to sell everything. This was a good clean-out strategy, actually. And then we kind of put it, you know, made it live and told some friends. And almost immediately, stuff started to sell. And I was like, oh. And then people called me and were like, oh, my God, I have, like, all this stuff from our move that's sitting in a warehouse somewhere that hasn't gone anywhere. And so very quickly we realized, okay, there's something here. There was a lot we were doing wrong, but there was a lot that we were doing right, or a nugget of what we were doing was right, and that's kind of what we ran with. And then we started to put together a team, and then for about the first, I'd say, 8 months to a year, we self-financed it and kind of ran it out of our house with friends, bootstrapping it.
Also think is important.
Yes.
I mean, that's also what we did. We had no money.
Right.
And we're just figuring it out and being scrappy.
Right.
And
you also have to do every single job when you do that. And, like, I learned so example, we had items at a flat price. So this sofa is available for $600, say. The first thing that happened is I'd get a call or an email from customer service. I was the customer service department saying, I love it, but I only want to pay $550. And I realized this is just like a flea market or an antique store. Or people say, what's your best price, right? Because it's all, you know, vintage mm-hmm. stuff. And we realized we didn't have that built in to our platform. And Shopify didn't really allow that. So, boom, that was like our first big development was we need the make an offer feature on vintage pieces. That's like, you know, and you learn that by picking up the phone and observing that. Or, you know, this person's having a problem with shipping. So, like, how do we work through that? So I loved that stage. And I actually still secretly answer a lot of our, like, at night I'll go online because I'm an insomniac and, like, read customer service emails and respond. And that I don't always say the right response. And sometimes I get told, please don't do that. But it is really fun to see how people are using the site. Like, there's nothing better. I love that. And real-time feedback like that is great.
So for the first year,
yeah,
you bootstrapped.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
And then we realized we needed a bigger team.
Wait, how are you finding furniture and items?
Yeah,
and, like,
so
how is that
great
happening?
Question. So interestingly, there's this huge need for people to sell things. I mean, how many people have storage spaces? It's such a waste of money, you know, or garages.
My entire garage right
yeah,
now because we
right,
just moved.
Right. So everyone has that. Mm-hmm. So that was our first source. But then what happened relatively quickly was we got some nice PR hits. This is all local, just in San Francisco. And what we call professional sellers, so vintage stores, consignment shops, all those kinds of people started calling us. And they were great because they had really good stuff, and they had lots of it. And so very quickly we could amass a larger scale of inventory. And so now on our site, about 95 to 98% of our inventory comes from what we call professional sellers versus private individuals. Because folks like you and I, like, we'll have stuff now and then, but once it's sold, it's sold.
Yeah.
And so this gives us a bigger base of supply.
So at what point – so one of the things that I love about the site is the way that it's merchandised and how beautiful it is. So
thanks.
At what point did you decide to go from, like, your point and shoot personal style photos to how beautiful it looks now?
Thank you. So a couple things. One is all the photography on the site of the product is actually still provided by the sellers. So it's all done mostly through iPhone. We do whiteout the background, so it looks pretty, but those are all iPhone shots.
You're kidding me.
Kind of amazing. I know. Well, you know, the camera's been on our side because the technology's gotten better and better in terms of what it provides.
That's amazing.
But the second thing was we've always had a pretty strict rules, which has sometimes been uncomfortable to enforce about what we'll accept. So, you know, we always have said, like, we want stuff that we think is stylish, pretty, and has quality to it. So I think for us, curation, which is such an overused word and I hate it, but it's really about taste level. And I think having a taste level is, you know, something that coming from the fashion business was really like, of course we're going to do that. And I have to say, pushed up against a lot of people in the technology space who go for scale.
And don't understand
taste. And they don't get it, especially because a lot of those people are men. And they're like, more is better. And it's like, well, more is better, but only more of good stuff.
Right. So, otherwise, it's just more is more.
Otherwise, it's just junky and nobody wants to be there.
So how do you so I obviously taste and having an eye is really important in our business as well.
Sure.
How do you hire for that? Because it's also a tricky thing.
It's so hard. Yeah, it's really hard.
I mean, like, an edit test is kind of a version of that. But how do you personally, when you're hiring, when you were making some of those early hires for your team, how did you communicate that?
Well, one thing I looked for is experience in terms of brands that they'd worked on and places that they'd gone and references from people who they worked with. So, like, I knew that if you had worked in places where style mattered and that you had excelled, that was going to be good, or that you know, you were in the ballpark. And then the second thing is I would actually ask them to edit on the site. So I'd say, what do you think that we accepted that we shouldn't have accepted?
So you gave them an edit test.
I gave them an edit test, yeah. But our edit test is, you know, sort of separating the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, in terms of the product. And also, do you think that we're missing something? Because sometimes a little raunchy stuff or a little funky stuff is, you know, you want that too because that's what makes the site exciting. And I do think that one of the things that makes Cherish exciting is in the world of e-commerce with the endless aisle of, you know, faux mid-century gray sectionals, it's really fun to have stuff that is one of a kind, unique. You don't see it other places.
Because it's going to speak to that person who's supposed to own it.
Exactly.
And that person will feel so passionately about it that then they'll also tell everyone in the world
about it. And I think that idea of every day, you know, we have at least a thousand new arrivals on the site. And that sense of discovery and surprise is really fun. It's never the same.
So what was the hardest part about those early days?
I think the hardest part about the early days was giving up some of my preconceptions about what I wanted the site and the experience to be like. And I mean that in a couple ways. I mean, one is I, coming from the fashion business where probably to a fault, things were perfected before they left. And I know, you know, brands get a lot of shit right now about, you know, airbrushing and all that.
Yeah.
You know, we did all of that. We retouched everything and, you know, guilty as charged. And we spent a lot of time color correcting. For me, the idea that we were going to release the site to the public with our names on it into the world sort of messy and ugly and in some cases, fundamentally broken, like there were things that just didn't work, was so uncomfortable to me. But I trusted my husband and co-founder and also our partners at the time who said, like, you know, the point I just made, which is you'll never get ahead if you don't learn from this mistake up front. And we'll spend time perfecting something that's wrong.
What is that saying about, like, if you're not embarrassed by your first iteration, you're too late?
My favorite quote ever from Reid Hoffman. Yes.
There.
It's a great one. If you're not embarrassed by the first version of your product, you launch too late.
There
and
you
I'm
go.
A firm believer in that, and I'm an example of that. And if I showed you the first version of it, you'd just die. I mean, it was so bad. But anyways, you know, that's how you learn. And then the second thing was there were some core fundamental things about the business that I thought we should be providing as a service that just economically didn't make sense. So at the time, when we were really focused on private individuals, I thought, well, we should pick up the product and store it in a warehouse so that it gets off, you know,
their space.
It's very convenient for the sellers. Sellers love that. It's totally economically a disaster. And it took us about only 3 months to figure that out. Like moving big things twice is, you know, once is almost too much. Like moving them twice and holding them in warehouses waiting for them to sell, especially when you're a smaller marketplace just beginning to develop, was really expensive and a mistake. And so I kind of had to walk away from that. And it's interesting. We had a lot of competitors in the space since we launched who've come up with that as a proposition. And none of them still exist. None of them still exist because it's just it burns money. So giving up, you know, like using your practical mind to kind of say goodbye to things that you felt really strongly were important, that's hard. But you kind of have to let those things go.
So one of the things that we talk about on this pod often is the idea of that skills that you develop in the workplace translate from industry to industry, mm-hmm. and that you shouldn't be paralyzed by the idea of, like, I went to law school and I'm a practicing lawyer, so that means I can't work in something in fashion, I can't work in something creative, or whatever that may be. That's obviously not true. There are skills that you learn at any job that you can translate into other things. So my question is this: what did you learn in the marketing world, specifically at Levi's, that you use on a daily basis with Cherish?
Two things. It's a great question, and I'm a firm believer in what you just said.
But when
it comes to mind was a big part of my job at Levi's, especially in the early days, was taking our marketing campaigns and our marketing programming, and Levi's spent a bloody fortune on marketing, number one name in jeans, and taking that out to the retailers who at the time were their primary distribution point and saying to them, we're going to spend $45 million at back to school advertising loose jeans on television in 1994. And your order looks really small. I think you should probably buy more of them. And so using your marketing campaign and the promise of that as a means to draw more business out of the market was a really powerful mechanism. And so when we were in the early days of Cherish, you know, it's a marketplace, so you need supply and you also need demand, and you're always sort of standing in the middle of that seesaw. And so the question was, how can we draw supply out of the market? And we would actually worked with you guys on a series of city guides where we would go into a city like LA and say, we're going to feature the top 25 vintage stores. Wouldn't you like to be one? And then we would do a shoot. We would photograph all of that. They would list their stuff on the site. We'd run it with you guys. And so it met both a supply and a demand need. And that was so important to us. And the work we did on My Domain closed that circle and kind of got us traction early in some of the markets we really wanted. So I think that's a trick I learned at Levi's that I was able to apply to this business and really kind of got us, especially in the professional selling community, a lot of credibility and traction. And then the second thing was just publicity, like the importance of storytelling and talking about, I mean, we have really interesting product to talk about.
That helps.
And working with interesting people who take this kind of pantry of ingredients and make their own looks out of it. And so bringing those partnerships and those relationships to life is something that we did both at Levi's, which in some ways is almost like a basic material product that people kind of make their own. And the same is true with what we're doing here. So oddly, there's a lot, you know, that carried over for sure.
So what advice would you give women who are interested in sort of making that leap? Because I think a lot of times our listeners want to switch gears, but they're not entirely sure how to do it or how to go about it. What advice would you give someone who's contemplating?
Well, I mean, the first is what we talked about, which is make sure it's something you really love, because no matter what you think, I'm sure you feel this way. If you'd known had any idea how hard this was going to be, you never would have done it.
100%.
Yeah. So you almost, like, it's good to be a little dumb because you're like, otherwise you'll never make that leap. But you have to really love it to stick with it. So make sure it's like, if you weren't at work, when you're home, when you're turning work off, is this something you like is this category, is this idea, is this brand, is this notion something you really want to engage and spend time with? So that's the first one. But in terms of actually getting started, like, I know a lot of people talk about side hustles and stuff like that. For me, that was never how I did anything. Like, I always, like, turned one thing off and turned the other wholly on. I have very distinct breaks in my life. I don't have a lot of overlaps in terms of I was kind of ending this part and starting this part. Like, it's very clear. And that's because I'm kind of feet first all in on stuff that I do, for better or for worse. So for me, it's sort of like you got to figure out how to take that plunge. And sometimes that might mean working for somebody in a related field and not really doing your own thing right away, but just knowing that industry.
Familiarizing.
Get into it deep. Because my, again, like, one thing that I'm always surprised by is how much time people are spending researching things versus, like, just go try it, you know?
I think there is a gut aspect of this world that people, I mean, I understand, like, the brain, the data, all of it. You have to have your facts, your ducks, all of that stuff. But it also should just speak to you.
Yeah.
And there's something amazing about that, like, when your gut just says, like, go for it, do it.
Right.
And you can figure it out as you go.
Right.
What advice would you give your younger self?
Oh, my gosh. So much advice. I think my advice to myself would be kind of put into perspective that these little small things that wake you up in the middle of the night, like, oh, God, I didn't do that. I spent a lot of my life worrying about those small details. And in a way, I think that was helpful. That got me where I was, is I was very reliable. Like, I was going to show up and get it done. But the amount of anxiety and stress that put on me, I think, was undue. So try to kind of have a little bit of a longer ball perspective.
I think that's so completely right. I mean, I know earlier in my life, I would get spun out internally on certain things that, like, you just don't, it wasn't helpful. It was just pressure I was putting on myself as a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. And I would get so upset internally, or, like, feeling like, oh, I'd failed in this. Or I, you know, the same thing as you wake up in the middle of the night worrying about something. And I have to say, you know, I'm only 6 months into this mom thing, but it has been really helpful in making me realize, like, okay, I can identify this at work as a problem, but it doesn't consume me in the same way. And I don't, and I think it actually makes me more effective that I have some perspective in a way that I didn't necessarily have it before, which is my experience.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that there's nothing more clarifying than kids when it comes to prioritization. Because, you know, as we say, if the kids don't come out right, nothing else matters. So you just spend a lot of time on that. And it does put the rest into perspective. That said, I'm sure my bosses loved it that I was up in the middle of the night worrying about, you know, if this chart had come out or if that commercial had been cut properly. So.
And it's a thing where and it's a fine line because you want to be passionate about things. But I think sometimes as women, we put this pressure on ourselves and, like, spin ourselves in a way that's not, like, actually productive or helpful. No one else necessarily sees it. It's just the, like, self-torture that we go through about feeling the need to be the best or to prove this or whatever, that piece of it, it's like, go, like, be kind to yourself.
Right. Easy to say, hard to do.
True story.
I love it as a, I love it as an idea.
Of all of the things that you have worked on, what are you most proud of?
I have to say it's kind of manifesting Cherish into the universe. Like, it was something that in my head I saw it. And it wasn't exactly like it looks now. It looks better than how I think I saw it. But bringing that to life for me has been so much fun. And I think one of the things I love about it is, you know, we don't talk a lot about this, and maybe we should, but we're a platform that supports over 10,000 small sellers across the country. And every once in a while, I'll be somewhere and a lady will come up to me and tap me on the shoulder and say, I was hated my job as a dental hygienist, and I always loved shopping at flea markets. And now that's my full-time job, is I sell on your site, and it's become my business. And I'm able to do something I love, and I'm so thankful for you for providing this platform for me to be able to do that. And that, to me, is just the most transformational moment, because it's like, oh, yeah, me too. Like, that is my story, you know? Like, I wasn't a dental hygienist, I had another thing, but we're all, like, looking for something in this space, and we found
it
together.
We're all dental hygienists on the inside.
Exactly. We're all cleaning teeth. But, you know, it is really, it is really meaningful to me when I hear that we're able to kind of help someone's dream come true and let them do something that they truly love. And, you know, it's a pretty sight and there's lots of fun stuff to buy. But that's what drives it, is people who have great eyes and who really care about this as a category and love to and love to share that and sell that. So it's fun.
Anna, dream maker, career maker. Thank you. That was perfect. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Cherish co-founder and chief marketing officer Anna Brockway. Thank you for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Anna, check out mydomain.com. As always, we'd like to know who you're interested in hearing from on this show, so please feel free to shoot us an email at secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram at Hillary Kerr. If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate us and review us. Also, if you'd like to screenshot us and put us in your stories and tag us and tag me and tell your friends and share with the world that you're listening to this podcast, that would be cool too. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by MyDomain.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.